Hey friends, you're listening to the Fun Therapy Podcast, where we dive into the horribly messy parts of our stories with a smile. No talking points and no shameless self-promotion. Nope, only beautiful imperfectness on display. And you may be asking, why do you call it fun therapy? Because this isn't funny. And Mike, you're not funny. And these conversations are difficult. But yes, we talk about the hard things here. But within the talking about the hard things, we find out that we're not alone, that hope is real, and we don't have to be afraid of our stories anymore. And with that comes great joy. My name is Mike Foster, and this is Fun Therapy. Now, before we get into this episode, I just want to say a quick thank you, seriously, for the amazing support and feedback you've been giving about the Fun Therapy Podcast. Your reviews and the ratings and comments on social media and direct messages, it means a lot to me. And so thank you. And keep the feedback coming. I read it all and I am listening. So on this episode of the Fun Therapy Podcast, I can't wait for you to listen in on my session with best-selling author Maria Goff. In her book, Love Lives Here, Maria shares how she has made a career out of loving her family and neighbors and turning houses into homes. She's married to New York Times best-selling author Bob Goff, who wrote the book Love Does and whom she calls the most helpful and interesting man in the world. And he really is. Together, they've started schools for marginalized kids in Uganda, Nepal, and northern Iraq. In this episode, Maria shares about how a previously unknown trauma from her childhood is brought to the forefront at the most unexpected time. As a quick side note, we discuss some sensitive topics that may not be suitable for very young ears, so parents use your best discretion. And now, let's listen in on this session of Fun Therapy featuring my friend, Maria Goff. So, Maria, get me up to speed on you and some of the things that are going on in your week right now.
2017 is a year in itself, but 2016 was something else for me, and I just kept thinking, what the heck? This year's amazing. All this stuff seems to be revealing itself, and I'm aware of things, or we're going through, struggles and crises, or, you know, we've all had some stuff in our family, and then I released a book in the middle of all of that as well. So this year is, in the world, crazier. But personally, inside of me, and I'm feeling a lot more grounded, and I'm super thankful for that. So I feel like there's hope for the world then, and all the stuff that's going on. Maybe we'll all kind of hit rock bottom and then bounce up to better days. But this has been an adventure to write a book that's full of personal stories.
Yes, very personal.
Yeah, and getting in touch with some of the feelings associated with those stories, I felt was important so that the story itself would be authentic. And all I kept thinking about is my kids, people I may never meet are going to read this. So I wanted to be as accurate as possible, as honest as possible, without filling it with a bunch of clutter and words that didn't need to be there. And that took me time because I had never written a book before. So just the process of writing is hard, but then the editing part of it and the, you know, like culling down to like what's really important here.
Because you're really putting yourself out there. And you're being fully known by not only your kids and people that know you, but a lot of strangers, a lot of people who don't know you.
Yes.
What was the biggest fear for you in terms of being known in that way? Like what?
It was so hard. When Bob wrote Love Does about 5 years ago, he put a whole chapter in his book called Sweet Maria. And Sweet Maria was like a nickname that he had given me, and people in our immediate family would call me that. And it was just kind of cute and endearing. But after people had read his book and would meet me at an event he was at, or I'd be out in public with him, they would come up to me and throw their arms around me and be like, sweet Maria, like we'd been friends forever. And this little part of my soul that's totally introverted would just kind of die a little bit because I was like, oh, I don't know who you are and who am I now? And I've got this persona, this sweet Maria. I was like, I had like a little identity crisis in that moment. And at the same time in my life, my kids were pretty much all grown up and had gone off to college and some were getting married. And so I was in this transition phase and Bob had a new career. He was shifting from being a full-time lawyer to doing part-time lawyering and writing a book and speaking. And I found myself a little lost at home. So, you know, what do I do with myself? And the people that I was meeting that were new all felt like they knew me, but I didn't know who I was. So, I ended up getting the help that I needed at that time.
And what did that look like?
That was through friends of friends of friends who had gone to a place in Nashville called OnSite and had come back from their experience with really remarkable stories of how their lives had been changed. And I'd taken note of that. And eventually, it was like they were planting seeds and they didn't know that they were planting those seeds. And eventually, I had to act on it when I knew in my life I was needing something just like that. I needed a life-changing counseling session or program that I could go to that would help. And I'd never been to something like that. It's like a 7-day program. You know, who does that? In my earlier years, when I hit rough spots, like as a teenager or early in college and needed help, I'd gone to traditional counseling. Mm-hmm. Some people call it therapy. I've always called it counseling. There'd been help out there where, you know, like once a week or once a month you go. But this was different. This was like I was going to go leave my family and go to a place and be with people I didn't know and commit that time to working on myself in a way that I'd never done before. And it's with a group of people. So you're assigned to like, I don't know, I think there was maybe 8 or 10 people in our group mm-hmm. and a counselor, and he's leading all of us through this unfolding during a week, like a planned program. The element of surprise, I think, was part of it for me. So I don't want to disclose too much what mm-hmm. happens. But I was really changed and affected by that experience. But the best part of it, I think, in my own healing was being able to help heal the people that were in the group, where you actually stand in their space and represent somebody in their life or an event in their life and just be there for them.
What was the thing that you worked on at OnSite? What was the kind of the core thing that you were addressing there?
For me, it was a lot of the pain from my childhood just kind of felt like it was still rearing its ugly head. I didn't have a peaceful childhood. I know my parents did the best that they could, but there was a lot of fighting and discord. And I'm also a 9 on the Enneagram, which were like peacemakers.
And
conflict is something that, you know, like it's a hot potato and we just don't even want to be near it.
So there'd be fight, your parents would be fighting, and then no one really talked about it?
Like, no, because they weren't doing their own work. They weren't in counseling while they were fighting. They just were surviving. Mm-hmm. And so my sister would spend time in her room and I would spend time in my room. And if I had to go out of the house, like get to the kitchen to get something to, like crackers or something to drink, I remember we had this blue shag carpeting. And one of my jobs as a chore each week was to vacuum the carpet and then rake it. Somebody in our family must have been OCD. So there couldn't be like any vacuum marks. We had to rake it. And I remember if I had to go to the kitchen after I had done this chore, I would kind of tiptoe. And thinking back on it now, it's like, how ironic. It was as if that blue shag carpeting was eggshells. And my childhood felt like that. Like I was always kind of tiptoeing through my childhood, hoping that I didn't like land on a, you know, landmine and cause an eruption somewhere, like, because then there would be conflict and that would, part of my soul would die because of that.
A childhood of walking on eggshells. This is Maria's upbringing. This is her childhood. And can you just picture the environment as she shares about how she had to tiptoe around the home and not step on any landmines causing an eruption between her parents? Psychologist Mark Cummings once said that children are like emotional Geiger counters. They pay close attention to their parents' emotions, and they're looking, always looking for information about how safe they are in the family. When parents are destructive, the collateral damage to the kids can last a lifetime. Children will learn to bottle up their emotions, to compartmentalize their feelings, to learn how to protect themselves and not cause any problems by burying everything inside. And so when parents fight or scream or have constant discord in the home, some children can become distraught and worried and anxious. The stress created in the home can interfere with their ability to pay attention and create academic problems at school. I don't think we fully realize how our environments impact us, and especially those environments that we grew up in when we were young. And this is why I ask her this question about what she learned about life at an early age.
So what did you learn as a child in those moments? Like you're walking on eggshells.
Yeah.
Your parents are fighting. There's discord.
Yeah.
You're wired up as a peacemaker and a nine.
Yes.
What did you learn about life in that context?
That I need to keep it in, lay low, and don't disturb the force field. And so as a child, if you've grown up like that, you just learn to suppress all your feelings, really. So good or bad, you're just like kind of living in this cave. So my experience at OnSite was the door flung open on that. And it was an invitation to just feel everything I've wanted to feel or express or share and have that drawn out of me in a really safe environment. Because I think if you're not used to expressing anger or your raw emotions or feelings, for me, the fear was, what if I do that and I come completely unglued?
Mm-hmm.
Like actually pieces of me fall apart on the floor in front of everybody and then that's it. Like there I am, like Humpty Dumpty. Like who's gonna put me back together again if that happens? But what I found out in this program that I was involved in, like it's good to do that. It's good to open up and be vulnerable and to trust the people that are there to help you, that they want to help you get over that so that you don't leave in shambles. You're actually leaving as a more whole, intact human being, mind, body, spirit, soul.
So was there anger that you processed there?
Yes, yes.
And what was the anger about?
The anger was about, that's a hard one to get into. But it was directed more toward the people that I felt that should be responsible for me and do a better job at that, and to not discount my feelings when I did have the courage to say, this isn't going well, I need help, to not have that reciprocated with the love that I needed, the support that I needed at the time. What I didn't realize is that that was going to tee me up for when I went back to OnSite after I realized something else about my life that had been hidden even deeper. And that was more of a suppressed memory, a disassociation for something that was probably the most horrific trauma that I'd ever experienced that happened really early on in the beginning of my life when I was a young girl. Like I think I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And I was abused by a relative who should have been taking care of me, and they didn't. And that came out of me from experiencing a real-time trauma. Like, as an adult, last year, our family experienced the loss of our lodge, this place that we had in Canada, mm-hmm. that we built for people to come to. It's like everything was good about this place. And because of the loss of the lodge and the sheer shock of that, I couldn't help but hit my own rock bottom and feel like I was exposed. Like everything about me was out in the open. And I didn't quite put my finger on at the time what was wrong with me. I thought, this feels more than just regular grief over the loss of something. And I was starting to have nightmares and I was like having seeing fire and things in the lodge burning, you know, in slow motion. And I would wake myself up and start walking around, and I try to snap out of it. And I remember telling Bob, like, this is bigger. This is bigger than just grief. I think I might need to get some help on this. And so then we thought immediately, since we're headed to Canada for the summer to go be with this place that is just burned down and help clear it out and make plans for what we're going to do in the future, maybe we can squeeze in a quick trip back to on site and talk with our friends Bill and Lori Loki, who are part of the program back there. And they were gracious enough to see me over a short weekend. And it didn't take long for Lori to crack that open and just asked about the lodge and what did it mean to me and how it felt like my safe place I was sharing with her. And then she said, has there ever been a time where you haven't felt safe? Those words just made the door fly open, and I just couldn't believe that I was actually sharing with another human being.
Did it all just become crystal clear?
Very crystal clear, yeah. Yeah, and then she wanted to do there's a type of therapy, EMDR, and I'd have to look up, I can't remember
EMDR.
What those, yeah. So it has something to do when there's trauma in your life, you physically, you can talk about what that trauma was, all the details left and right, up and down, but at some point you have to like enter into the physical, you know, physically active process of getting in touch with that. So EMDR is this thing where it's your eye movement going, track somebody's finger going back and forth as you're remembering. And it was, I said, do we have to?
Wow.
And she said, we don't have to if you don't want to, but I think this will really help with the grief you're experiencing right now. And of course, then I was like, I don't want to feel this grief that I'm experiencing. It's later called complicated grief, when you're grieving one thing and something else comes up through it. So, and it's the first time I'd ever heard of that, but I was feeling it. And I knew I wanted to get past that. I didn't want to just live with that the rest of my life. So we moved forward, and we went back to the moment that I was abused and memories of what all happened and all of the details. And during the course of doing that, in that couple of days, it occurred to me, oh my gosh, I need to share this with Bob. Like, I mean, I'm in this room with Lori, and we're making great progress, but now we need to bring in Bob and let him know. And the shame that I felt that there was this thing in my life that was, you know, something that he didn't know that was so personal, you know, it was like the body shame involved with that, and how that's probably messed me up, and how he's inherited it through marriage. So, you know, how do I do that? And they were right there for me, both Bill and Lori, and Bob came into the room and let me share my story. And it took forever. It took me forever to get the words out.
Yeah.
And they were incredibly patient, because I was like I was crying and praying that God would give me the words to say. And Bob was just sitting there so patiently holding my hands, and I could see like the tears welling up in his eyes. And I have a lump in my throat. I can barely speak, but we got it out. And it was just like this catharsis to finally take this big, ugly, gross thing in my life and just like get it out of me and let it land in the middle of our little powwow in an incredibly loving, safe environment. And Bob was like so supportive, saying, you know, I would want the lodge to burn again if this is what it took to get you to this place where you are not carrying this anymore. This isn't part of who you are anymore. It's something that happened to you, but you don't need to hang on to it. And then he said, which I totally love, I'll probably cry. He said, he took a breath and he was like, you know, I know this guy's dead now, but if I could figure out where he's buried, I would dig him up and kill him again. And we all, the absurdity of that made us laugh, but it was just so sweet. And it's what you want to hear when you've had a bad person in your life. You want to hear your loved ones say, you know, do you want me to go punch their lights out? You want me to rip their head off? You want me to go kill them again? You know, it was just so like, it gave me power in the moment that, you know, I was definitely married to the right guy.
What a profound and vulnerable thing Maria is sharing in this moment. You and I are being brought into this incredibly tender part of her story. this is hard to talk about. To be violated at a young age and then to carry this trauma for so many years hidden deep within her story. As she's sharing, there's two things that are important to notice. First, how absolutely difficult it is to get the words out. How deeply shame will bind us up. It thrives in secrecy and it demands loyalty. And for Maria to be brave enough to say the words, to speak those words, it broke the control it had over her. Secondly, the response to this disclosure, this vulnerability, this horrific moment that happened in her childhood, the response to this is absolutely critical. To be met with love and compassion from the person who means the most to her in life is so important. Too many times I've seen parents and friends and spouses minimize or diminish someone's abusive experience when they share it. This is kryptonite and will drive the victim back into secrecy and shame. But Bob's response is exactly what Maria needed in that moment.
You know, obviously the process of getting to those words is a very long, hard, emotional process. But when you said the words, and what were the words that were the most difficult to say? And then what did you feel like after that?
The raw truth of I have been violated. My personal space, my innocence, my you know, just the whole sweetness of how life is supposed to be was taken from me. There's just something so profoundly sad about that. And I know in this world, bad stuff happens, but I crave Eden because I think I just didn't have, you know, like a, I didn't have that for very long. You know, I think we all want to give that to our kids for as long as we can, that sense of nothing bad ever happens. This is a safe place. It's like this magical wonderland here on earth. When the truth of the matter is that it's not. There's really horrible things that can happen, but
it was stolen early in your story.
Yeah. And then I think because I'm an adult, remembering that, there's just so much shame involved. And to be honest, sort of a sense of pride that, you know, like, this happened to me. Darn it. I really wish it hadn't. And why did it? I didn't deserve that. Like, there's like all of these emotions bubbling up in that moment that had been suppressed for so long. So I didn't know what that would look like as I was sharing it to the most important person in my life, my husband. I didn't know what that was going to sound like. And also I'm trying at the same time, I remember feeling I wanted to protect him. Like how I say this, I need him to have the ears to really hear it, that it's nothing. He isn't responsible for it. And I'm married to a man who's incredibly capable of dealing with life. And so I know that if he feels like he can't fix something or protect me or whatever, it would just be really hard on him. So here I am trying to share my own thing, but at the same time trying to care for him in the words that I'm using, but yet I can barely say the words myself. So
tell me about you talking to your kids about this.
Yeah.
So Bob knew.
Yes.
But you're writing about this and your kids don't know.
Yeah.
What did that look like?
Well, it was one of the hardest things I think I have ever had to do. And I prayed a lot about it, that the timing would be right, that the, you know, who and how, you know, well, I knew the who part, but like, do we call a family meeting or do I just, you know, meet with them one-on-one? And some of the other stories that had already been written in the book before this bubbled up where I thought, I need to let them know. So I had a few dress rehearsals for the big one, and they were really kind and supportive. But this one was huge for me, and so I assumed it would be huge for them. But what I hadn't factored into is that they're really loving people. And I met with them one-on-one. And I said, okay, you guys, there's another story that I know I need to write about because it's part of my story. And it's what made grieving the lodge so hard for me. My grief was complicated because there's another part of my life that was revealed through the burning down of the lodge. And I've had this suppressed memory. So I need to share that with you before it gets published because I don't want you to read the book and find out about it. And if you don't want me to put it in, I won't put it in. And that was really, really hard to actually find the words for them too. But with my experience sharing with Bob, I kind of knew I needed to just get to the fact that when I was a little kid, this is what happened to me. And it was really hard, and I suppressed the memory. I thought I would never have to talk about it. But here's the thing about pain in our lives is that it will reveal itself at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We might want to kid ourselves that it won't, that we can just go on and act like everything's normal and try to function, but eventually it reveals itself, and this is how it was revealed for me, and I need you guys to know about it. And they just were all so loving. You know, there was tears, there's hugs, there's their, I'm so sorry that happened, you know, that all that compassion that you would want and hope for. They all gave that to me, which was really beautiful.
I love what she shares in this moment. It's a truth of life, and it's simply when it comes to our pain, our trauma, and the things that we feel shame about, when it comes to sharing these parts of our story, there's this simple truth. The people that love us most are sometimes the hardest people to tell. Why is it that we can tell a complete stranger about our struggles, but not those who know us best? Sometimes we falsely believe that we need to protect the people we love from our pain, and they can't handle it, or we don't want to burden them with it. Perhaps maybe right now you're carrying something heavy, something that you're having difficulty getting the words out. I love the movie We Bought a Zoo, where the character played by Matt Damon says to his son, you know, sometimes all you need is 20 seconds of insane courage. Just literally 20 seconds of just embarrassing bravery, and I promise you, something great will come of it. Friends, all you have to do is find your 20 seconds of insane courage, and in that moment, you can begin your journey to freedom.
So let me ask you a question. Those words are hard to get out to Bob in that on-site meeting.
Yes.
The words are hard to get out with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Are the words still hard to get out?
Yes, because I'm still feeling, yes and no. The yes would be because I'm still feeling protective of the story itself for a couple reasons. I don't want it to become my identity that I was sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
Like any of us with the bad things that have happened in our life, we don't want that to be our big billboard.
Yes.
There's a bigger story, and it's how God redeems that and uses it and turns our pain into our passion. And so I'm always protective of that. Like, let's not focus too much on our pain. What did we do with it is the better story. I also am really respectful of the fact that while this was new knowledge for me that I'm sharing, it's also new knowledge for people that are around me and my family who I have not had that conversation with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, the ripple effect of family and the family tree, and not everybody knows. And, you know, maybe they had the same experience with the same person, but it's their story to tell. So I try not to name names. I want to be really careful with that story.
Yes.
To not reveal all of the gory details because they're just not needed. We can get stuck on that. The world loves that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the best
yes.
articles or the movies or whatever. And sometimes it's necessary to know more for the sake of helping somebody. But I just trust God that he'll let me know, you know, who those people are and how I can share that with them. But the bigger story is what he's doing. It's not the past. It's what we're doing with the pain that we've experienced.
How have you changed since going through this whole season of really doing some really deep work in your own story? How are you a different Maria today?
It's pretty wild because I feel like it's happened. A specific amount of growth has happened in a short period of time. So it's almost tangible. You know, I think sometimes when, you know, I get a glimpse of my kids at how much they've grown, and it kind of takes me by surprise, you know, because you're kind of there every day and it's just like, wow, you've actually really grown. I haven't always been in touch with how much I've grown over the years. But this last year and a half, it's palpable to me, and I'm actually pretty excited about what could be happening.
So what is the growth? What are the things that you see specifically?
Here's the thing. After Love Lives Here launched and it got out in the world, I was so happy for that, you know, like that final push. But what I felt afterwards was this crazy kind of anxiousness, depression overcame me. And I didn't really want to get out there and, you know, promote it. I didn't want to talk about it. I just like let it just land where it does and do its own thing. But I started hearing back from people. So I was feeling encouraged. But at the same time, I'm like, why aren't I feeling the joy of this? Like, this was a huge accomplishment. I've learned so much in the process. It's affecting people's lives in a positive way. Like, why can't I feel the joy in that? And the anxiety and the depression was kind of taking center stage for me. And so I started reading like I do, you know, when I get stuck, hadn't gone back to on-site or anything, but I was talking to, you know, people that I could trust with.
You're aware of these emotions.
I'm aware of it, yeah. And I'm feeling kind of torn, like, this is, darn it, I don't want to be in this place anymore. I want to be celebrating life, and I'm not right now. Why is that? And then something that Brené Brown talks about of the vulnerability hangover that a lot of us get when we enter the arena mm-hmm. and we're out there doing our thing. Oh my gosh, I thought there's a term to hang on what I'm feeling right now. And I was so grateful for that. And so I immediately interpreted it as, well, what we know about hangovers to cure them is we're not supposed to do more of the same. So when people said, when's your next book? Or will you come speak? Or whatever, you know, I'm like backpedaling as fast as I can. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm trying to recover and do the best I can to my own abilities to get over whatever I'm feeling. Then a book landed in my lap, and it's called, I've got it right here, because it's like a current book. It's called The Body Keeps the Score.
Absolutely. Bessel van der Kolk.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Such a good book, because it's talking about how trauma has this imprint on our bodies. And you can't just acknowledge trauma and move on. You actually have to do the work to get rid of it. And as I'm just diving into this book, thinking a lot of things are resonating on every page, I get to this one story about the people that they've been able to monitor and research that survived after 9/11 at Ground Zero. They were either the first responders, or they were in the building or nearby, and they were like the epicenter of trauma. And so enough time has gone by that they've been able to contact those people and see how they're doing. Aside from counseling or therapy, which is awesome, what resonated the most to me was my big missing piece. And the four things they all did, the ones that are doing the best, is yoga, acupuncture, meditation, and massage. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my gosh.
Body stuff.
All the body stuff. So I dove into that. I'm like, okay, I have been practicing yoga for a while, actually when it was really a sketchy thing. I went ahead and got 2 hours of the 200 hours of yoga teacher training, and I called a pastor friend first because I thought, the stuff I'm hearing about Christians and yoga, is this okay?
Like, oh boy.
But in my own like self-recovery way, even back then, I was noticing yoga is actually helping me.
Yes.
Like, I'm actually not as anxious as I usually am. Not being able to associate the source of my anxiousness or where depression was coming from. I hadn't really knit all of that together. But after writing a book about all of it, it's clearly knit. I know what my trigger points are. I know where my pain's coming from. And so now I'm going back to yoga with new eyes, understanding it's actually healing my body. I found a local acupuncture place that's ironically 2 blocks from our house here. And I've been going a couple of days a week and getting acupuncture to heal my anxiety and depression that comes from trauma. Also a side note, like lack of energy from the hormonal stage that I'm in life, it heals that. And then just that overall sense of well-being, if your organs aren't operating to the full capacity, you know, then you just don't feel good. So all of those things are keeping me from really feeling the joy that we're all intended to feel when God blesses us and creates this life for us and gives us opportunities and the people that are so beautiful around us and this, all, everything. Like, if you're missing it, there could be reasons why.
As Maria has begun to address the trauma, she's discovering something quite powerful. And that is how the body plays an integral role in the healing process. I teach this in my Rescue Academy workshop, how critical the body is to finding true healing. And my basic belief is this: when it comes to healing, for most people, and even within the church, the body is like the ignored middle child. We love to talk about the spirit and the soul and thoughts and emotions, but the body, we ignore the body, and yet the body is the container where the pain and trauma reside. We have to honor trauma and see trauma as a cellular thing and understand that there are certain types of trauma that words will never reach. The body work that Maria is doing is critical, especially when it comes to sexual abuse. Talk therapy is important. Prayer is important. The soul is important. However, it is naive and short-sighted to ignore the critical importance the body plays in finding our healing.
I love that about you, Maria, that you are doing the work.
Yeah.
It's one thing to simply be aware of our emotions and aware of the vulnerability hangover. It's another to say, to pursue freedom and to pursue health, even in things that may feel funky or not spiritual, like yoga.
Oh,
I don't know.
Gosh.
Is it a yoga?
Acupuncture, you, yoga?
Like, you do the thing that I love about you, do what you need to do.
Yes.
That is what's required in terms of we really want to have wholeness in our life.
Yes. Yeah. And the meditation is total prayer. And I'm having a hard time finding a comfort level in the massage because I by nature and by my experience, have tended to be more modest. And so I'll go get a manicure, pedicure, up to the elbows, up to the knees, a facial, stay in my face, don't go below my neck, you know, that kind of thing. But I can see that's where I need to heal. Like, that's going to do some amazing things for me in feeling free in my own body.
Yes.
And that is back to where I didn't feel free. So the motivation behind it is to just kind of take back some of the stuff that's been robbed and it shouldn't have been. But here's the thing, my biggest motivation, and this book has helped me to see this too clearly, is that when we hold this trauma in and don't do our work to get it out, we may think we're doing fine. Like, I could say, well, you know, I got married to Bob and we have these great kids and we're doing these fun things. And I wrote a book for Pete's sake. So, you know, like, why do I have to do my work? Like, everything from the outside looks as if I'm okay. But on the inside, that trauma starts to eat away at your soul, I think. I mean, I kind of felt like publishing the book and getting it out there and not feeling the joy associated with that huge opportunity and blessing was if my dimmer switch, my internal dimmer switch, was being pulled down. And that's what this book is like really good at. Like, eventually, if you don't do your own work, then your personal, your private, your professional life will become dim.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go all the way to the finish line just dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And we know people that look like that's happening to them. And I just thought that I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't think God intended for us to stop living a vibrant life. I don't think he intended for us to stop growing and learning and sharing what we're learning and how we're growing with other people. Like, we're here together.
One of the things that they talk about in the book, The Body Keeps the Score, that you've been referencing, is this, the impact of trauma on our sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that in your life?
Totally.
And the impact?
Yes. And it was so good to read about it in the book, because I thought it just described how I feel all the time, this sense of anxiousness. And so what I'm learning, I'm not a doctor, scientist, or whatever, but what I understand about what our sympathetic nervous system does, it's there working on purpose to protect us. So it's that it regulates that fight or flight. So like in a moment, when you need to get away from something, it kicks into gear. So it the fight or flight is what keeps us from the saber-toothed tiger attacking us. So then our parasympathetic nervous system is the one that just operates our bodies, and it's a functioning part of us. But if it doesn't have a chance to work, it gets overridden by this sympathetic nervous system. And so in trauma, the sympathetic nervous system gets kicked into gear and stays there. And so this was so great to be able to have this visual to explain to Bob what I just learned and what this self-awareness that I was starting to develop as far as healing my body. I said, so imagine that when I wake up in the morning, even though I might have had a great night's sleep, my sympathetic nervous system is always on, and I wake up wondering where the saber-toothed tiger is. And subconsciously, like I don't talk about it or anything, but subconsciously, that's how I move through my day. So it was good for us. Like as a couple, there's some times where if he has a crazy idea and my sympathetic nervous system is on overdrive, that's probably why I'm not having an easy time understanding why he wants to do something crazy. Because it's like I almost can't physically accept that as, you know, like something that we're going to go do. It's like, I just can't do that. So that's been really helpful to know, like as I'm having times of prayer where I'm still, or when I'm in yoga and I'm in this position that's called a supine twist, or I'm in acupuncture and we're opening up, you know, like our energy channels. I'm still a Christian. I just want you to know. It can sound funky, but I'm
listen, healing is funky.
Healing is good, but healing is like traditionally was Eastern, you know, and I'm very Western.
God owns it all.
He totally does. You know, all of these things that I'm learning, I'm actually experiencing them in real time as I'm practicing them, and I can feel my body relax, and it feels like I'm becoming more whole, and things are repairing, and I'm calming down. And that's all not on drugs. This is all by nature, which is awesome to me. The position I was talking about, in yoga, where you're in a supine twist, you're flat on your back, and your arms are out like a T, and you pull your feet like up towards your rear and make a teepee with your legs, and then let your legs fall to the left and your chin to the right. And now you are in the most prone position. All of your vital organs and your arteries and everything are so prone. Your sympathetic nervous system knows that your body is in a position where you are totally vulnerable and it wants to kick into gear. But in yoga, your other nervous system says, it's okay. I got this. We're relaxing. You're safe. You're going to be fine. And the first time that I did that in yoga is just, this is just so current. Like, I think that was Wednesday. I silently wept because it was like I could be in that position, a position a lot of people are in when they're violated, and realize I'm going to be okay. I can be whole again. I can be in this world and feel relaxed and enjoy the joy and the beauty of everything around me.
I feel like when I talk to people about shame, how shame discolors all other feelings.
Yes.
Trauma does the same thing.
Yep.
It discolors there's a muted grayness that just covers everything.
Yes. And even at a young age, the morning after I had been violated or molested or whatever anybody wants to call it, I was too young to know, like, what was that? I felt like the world's colors had changed. I was completely aware of that. And I kind of stayed in that mode, like, this is just life.
This is the new normal.
This is it, yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, God's timing is God's timing, and it's so beautiful that I don't want to, it's not God's fault that I'm sitting here now at my age saying I've just realized actually the color of the world is different. I could have figured that out later, but for whatever reasons, I'm doing that now, and I'm incredibly grateful for it, but I would want the message to be, like, don't wait. Your life is beautiful. It's just waiting for you on the other side of your trauma and your pain, but you just get the courage to go through it. Find the right counselor or therapist. Get word of mouth. One of the first counselors that I found here in San Diego a couple years ago was found through a Bible study I was in, and this gal was having some marital problems, and she came and she would share like how much this was helping her. Her counselor said this or that, and I'm listening to the thing that the counselor was saying to her, and I thought, that's really good advice. That must be a really good counselor, because that's what I would want to be telling my friend right now. You know, I just thought, I got to get that counselor's number. So sometimes word of mouth is the best way to go and find the right person for you. And, you know, some people can't go that route right away. And, you know, I've had good friends in my life, too, that I think have shouldered some of the burden with me as I've tried to work through something. You, look at you, sitting here right now helping me now where I'm at. I really appreciate that. Like, I think that's what community does. I think that's what friendship is, when we can talk to each other and have these conversations that are really real. And we're honest about the motivations behind why we feel the way that we feel. Like, we're not afraid to dig deep. We're not afraid to go below the surface.
And that, my friends, ends this session of Fun Therapy with my special guest, Maria Goff. I want to make sure that you check out Maria's book, Love Lives Here, Finding What You Need in a World Telling You What You Want. This is an incredible book. True story. I was reading the book, one of the chapters, I think it was chapter 5. I read chapter 5, and it was so good that I just started over reading that chapter again. I read it twice in a row. So compelling. She shares so beautifully from her story and some of the things that she has faced in her life. It's available at Amazon. Love Lives Here, Finding What You Need in a World Telling You What You Want. Also, if you have been impacted by sexual abuse or trauma, I want to recommend a couple resources. Number one, Maria mentioned the on-site program in Nashville. I have personally been through this program, and I cannot recommend it enough. The work is healing and transformative. And you can learn more about this at onsiteworkshops.com. Also, two books I want to recommend. A book, number one, called Healing the Shame That Binds You by John Bradshaw. And also the book, The Body Keeps the Score, which Maria mentioned during our conversation. Bottom line, you don't have to live a dimmed life anymore because of past abuse. You can live fully alive. It's possible, and I encourage you to take a next step towards healing. If you like the Fun Therapy podcast and have found this to be valuable, please subscribe and leave a review or a rating on iTunes. Tell your friends. We're just going to continue to talk about some honest things over the next episodes to come. I want to say thanks to Sleeping at Last for providing the music for this episode. You can learn more about Ryan and Sleeping at Last and get his music at sleepingatlast.com. And remember, Fun Therapy is a proud member of the Relevant Podcast Network. For more shows from the Relevant Podcast Network, make sure to check out relevantmagazine.com/podcasts. If you want to learn more about me, connect with me, Mike Foster2000 on Instagram, or you can hop over to my websites at mikefoster.tv or secondchance.org. Thanks again for listening. Keep the emails and the tweets and the reviews coming. And remember, no matter what has happened in your story, that your setbacks can become your superpowers, and honesty is always the best policy. We'll see you next time on the Fun Therapy Podcast.